Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the next to last class, the fifth class, in the Discovering Buddhism Module Mind and Its Potential. This is going to be the last didactic class, and then next week we'll do more meditation than we have been doing, and we'll do some general, have an open floor for discussion for anything that we've touched on in this class. Let's see, do we have anyone who's here for the first time tonight? Oh, a bunch of people, okay. It's going to be a little bit difficult subject tonight. We're going to finish mind and mental factors, but I hope you get something out of it. And then tonight, after the class, there's going to be a discussion group out in the lobby, and Susie will be leading that. And okay. Okay, so anybody who wants to participate in that is more than welcome.
Well, whatever we've covered in the
class. Okay, great. Any other logistical announcements? Okay. So we'll begin with some meditation. I think people are developing some familiarity with the process of meditation, hopefully. Okay. So we begin by establishing our posture. The point of the posture not being to torture ourselves or inflict pain upon ourselves, but to establish a steady posture that won't distract our mind, won't become an object of attention in and of itself during the meditation. So the most important point about the posture is that our back is a little bit straighter than we normally sit. Not rigid, but as if we're stretched out a little bit. So we're a little bit more vertical. This opens the energy channels that flow in front of the spine. Not visible when you dissect the body, but according to the Tibetan physiologic texts, there are these energy channels or channels of the wind. And it's said that our consciousness actually rides on those winds. So that's why we want to have it be nice and straight during the meditation, so those channels aren't blocked. Starting from the top, our head is straight on our shoulders, not tipped to one side or the other, maybe just a couple degrees in front of the vertical, but not such that our chin is on our chest. Said the most beneficial way to use the eyes is to have them just very slightly open, so a little bit of light comes in and keeps us from getting sleepy. But it's fine to close your eyes lightly if you find the light distracting. Our lips are lightly closed, our jaw is not clenched. Our shoulders are relaxed and down. Lots of times we have some tension there, so you may want to shake them out. And a little bit to the back, so our chest is open. Our upper arms are away from the sides of our body. And we can either sit with our hands on our knees, or what's more typical in the Tibetan tradition, right hand on left, with the thumbs touching just slightly below the level of the navel. Any position that we find comfortable for our legs is fine. If you're sitting in a chair, putting a cushion under your feet is perfectly acceptable. If you're sitting on the floor on a cushion, move a little bit towards the front of the cushion. You don't want to be sitting towards the back, but towards the front so that your pelvis is opened up. And any variation on crossing your legs is fine, from just crossing them on up to a full lotus position. So take a moment, starting at the top of your head, Review the posture. Identify any sources of tension or discomfort and deal with those now so that the posture is just kind of self-maintaining during the actual meditation. And now that you've established the posture, we'll begin with three deep breaths from the abdomen so that the stomach expands on the in-breath and then contracts towards the spine on the exhalation. So do three really deep breaths like that. And now allow your breathing to return to its normal pattern. And as always, we begin the meditation session by setting our motivation, thinking about why we're here, all the other things we could have done tonight. We decided to come here and meditate and discuss. So whatever motivated us to come here is fine. There are no bad motivations. We may just have come out of curiosity. That's fine. We may have come because we find that the meditation helps us relax a little bit, be a little bit calmer. That's great. But it's said that the most powerful motivation, the one that gives the most force to our meditation, is what's called the bodhicitta motivation. The thought that everything I do, from the time I get up in the morning, brush my teeth, go to work, till I lie down at night with my head on the pillow and sleep, everything I do is with the intention of becoming enlightened, by which we mean completely developing my mental powers of wisdom and compassion, so that I can become enlightened to benefit others. So there are really two parts of it. Everything, become enlightened for the benefit of others. So if we can just generate that motivation a little bit before the meditation, that's fantastic. So just think along those lines for a moment. And having set our motivation, we can now begin the actual meditation practice. What we're doing is a simple concentration meditation. The object of concentration is the movement of breath in and out through our nostrils. Nothing more and nothing less than that. Simply the movement of the air in and out. The physical sensation of air moving in and out through our nostrils. We just place our awareness, our perception on that experience. We're not describing it to ourselves. We're not thinking about it. We're directly experiencing it without commentary or any kind of mental chatter. And when we notice, as we inevitably will, that our concentration has wandered off to something else, a sound, or a physical feeling, or a memory, or a plan, we just drop that, not getting angry with ourselves, but just setting that aside, and come back to the breath. The simple movement of the breath in and out. Thank you. And we can bring our meditation to an end, as always, with a dedication. We acknowledge that we've done something positive. We've made a very small but important imprint on our mind stream. And may that ripen in the future in a way that is of benefit to all sentient beings. Questions or comments about that practice? Yeah.
Is it normal to, when you're meditating, to lose touch with your body, you know, just to go so deep into it that you lose, you don't feel, you're not aware of your body? Is that normal?
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that shows you're developing some ability to concentrate on whatever the object is. If you're not continually going back to how the body feels, I think that'd be a sign of progress. I don't know. What do other people think? I mean, not to the point that you're falling out of the chair, but... Okay. Anyone else? Okay. So, tonight I wanted to finish the... discussion of mind and mental factors, which we started last week and didn't get very far with, and it's going to be somewhat of a sprint tonight through all 51 mental factors. Not that you need to know all of them, but I just want to introduce them. Okay, so this is one of the models, one of many. It's not a particularly good one, bright one, that the Buddha gave us of how to understand our mind. Mind and mental factors. Does anybody remember what the Tibetan name for this topic is? It's a big topic in Buddhism, and there are lots of different texts on this subject. Lo-rig, yes, thank you. Not Lo-jong, which is thought transformation. So in the Buddhist model of the mind, we've talked about how our mind is lacking in any fixed qualities. It's in the nature of clear space, empty space. We can think of it as empty space in which one thought after another comes into existence, arises, and then subsides, followed by another, by another. Supposedly 65 during the snap of a finger. Just one after another. Boom, 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 boom. Boom, 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 boom. And the Buddha said, we're not having two thoughts that we can't think about two thoughts at the same time. It may seem like they're occurring simultaneously, but we're actually going back and forth very quickly. So the Buddha said, you know, what is the nature of these moments of mind? And one way he described that is through the theory of mind and mental factors. First, he says, each moment of thought, each separate thought or moment of consciousness is composed of what's referred to as a primary, and unfortunately, when they translate this into English, they call it a primary mind, plus various mental factors. And as I said, there are 51 mental factors, almost as many as Heinz has sauces, right? But not quite. Okay, a primary moment of mind, or just for shortness sake, we'll say primary mind, but we're just referring to a moment of thought, is just direct perception of an object. And the object can be something physical, it can be a memory, it can be a person, it can be an emotion, but it's just direct, unanalytic, non-conceptual perception. Okay. Not understanding, not having a story about anything, just a very neutral perception. And it is the combination of mental factors that accompany that primary moment of mind or primary mind that give it its flavor, its story, its emotional impact, its charge for us. And we'll go through the list of the 51 factors. There's some that are beneficial, some that are harmful. And the Buddha is saying we can actually learn, cultivate the beneficial mental factors, the ones that lead to happiness, the ones that lead to calmness, the ones that lead to insight, the ones that lead to compassion, and we can also get rid of the negative mental factors. We have the power to do that because these primary moments of mind are always accompanied by some of the mental factors. That's what gives them their taste, their qualities, because the primary moment of mind is just neutral perception of the object. Okay? Any questions about what I've said so far or comments? So we have moment after moment, primary moment of mind, primary moment of mind, primary moment of mind, each accompanied by various mental factors. If you think there's 65 of them in the snap of the finger and there are possibly 51 mental factors with each one, you know, you think, it's hopeless. How can I control this? But the Buddha said we can actually develop certain habits in meditation. Okay? So, let's see. It's the mental factors that give us our experience around us, about things we like, things we don't like, things that make us happy, things that make us unhappy. The direct perception of what is out there is very neutral. It's what we add on to that perception from our mind, not because it's out there inherently in the object, but it's our mind adding these mental factors on that gives us our experience of our world. So we can't control what's out there, but we can control our mind, according to the Buddha. So, 51 mental factors, and I'm going to try and run through them all very briefly tonight, but don't, I mean, you're welcome to write them down. They're in lots of text, and the translations for them into English is always quite variable, but I'm more interested that you just listen and get a sense. Last week we talked about their five omnipresent, present mental factors. That means every primary of moment of mind is always accompanied by all of these five. Okay, if these five were not present, there would be no perception. There would be no awareness. So a primary moment is always accompanied by these first five. Can anybody remember what they were? Feeling. Yeah, I like, I don't like, I don't care. Uh-huh. Discrimination. Intention. Yeah. Contact. Great. And the last one is attention. Okay. These accompany every primary moment of mind. There's a feeling of I like, I don't care. Discrimination means the ability to recognize cushion and what is not cushion, to distinguish cushion from non-cushion. There's intention, the movement of the mind towards the object. There's the actual contact of the mind and the object. And don't get hung up on what these means. attendance. I meant attention, excuse me. I wasn't paying attention. My intention was good, and attention is the mind staying on the object. So what determines whether we like something, don't like it, or don't care about it? Karma. That's the result of our past actions of body, speech, and mind. The fact that I like the color blue and I don't like the color orange is not arbitrary or random. Even something as simple as that is determined by karmic imprints that were placed on my mind, that I placed on my mind stream in the past. Every action of body, speech, and mind, everything we do, everything we say, and everything we think makes a karmic imprint on our mind that ripens as our future experience. Yes?
How do you account for likes and dislikes?
That's karma also. Your karma's changing. You've used up the karma that likes blue, and the karma that likes orange is ripening. Yes, the question was, how do you account for change? The fact that our likes and dislikes change, okay? And this is not an intellectual think about level. This is just that gut instinctive, I like something, I don't like it. A very primitive, unrefined sort of response to everything that we come into contact with. We really come into very few things that we're have a neutral feeling about. Those are pretty rare if we look, if we're willing to look closely. Okay? So those are the five omnipresent mental factors. Then there's what's referred to as the five object ascertaining, or ascertaining. And just to go through these so you understand what they are. Aspiration, appreciation, mindfulness, meditative concentration, and sublime awareness. Which can also be thought of as wisdom. So these are not always present with every primary moment of mind. Okay? Aspiration, appreciation, mindfulness, meditative concentration, sublime awareness. They're not there, okay, lots of times. They're qualities that we hope to develop and bring into our mind stream, but they may be quite rare initially. Let's see. Aspiration is having a strong interest in the object. Appreciation is when you understand the value of the object. And don't get too hung up on these definitions because they're a little strange. Mindfulness is an important one. This is the mental factor that brings us back to the object when our mind wandered away. That's what mindfulness is in Tibetan Buddhism. It's that mental factor that brings your mind back to the object. When we're meditating on the breath, we realize our mind's not on the breath. Mindfulness is what's bringing it back. That's a mental factor at work when we come back to the breath. That's an easy place to see one of these. Meditative concentration is the ability to keep the mind on the object single-pointedly, without wandering away, okay? So that if you develop meditative concentration, you don't need mindfulness because your mind's not leaving the object, okay? Meditative concentration is staying on the object. And then sublime awareness is really understanding the object. So if we're talking about a cushion, you know, there's not much to understand. But if it's an emotion or an idea, it's really deep insight into what the object is. So mindfulness leads to concentration. Concentration leads to awareness or wisdom. Okay, so we can't just grab some sublime awareness. We have to develop it by practicing mindfulness. When we've mastered mindfulness, then we have concentration. We stay on the object. As we stay on the object, we have wisdom, insight into its ultimate nature. Okay? The five object ascertaining mental factors. Not present in every moment of primary, with every moment of primary mind. Okay, and then there are the four variable factors, mental factors. Sleep, the mind becoming dull, regret, unhappiness over past actions, general examination, which is really an elaboration of the sublime awareness, and then precise analysis. Okay. These mental factors here we would qualify as neutral. These first five, the ones that are always present, these are beneficial, okay? Leading to happiness, quieting the mind. These are called variable because they can be either beneficial or destructive, based primarily on the object. If we regret having done something negative, having hurt someone, that's said to be a beneficial mental factor. If we regret having done something helpful, if we regret our good actions, that's a destructive mental factor. Sleep can be beneficial when it's needed, but if our mind is continuously dull, that's a negative mental factor. Okay? Verse 14. Okay, so that leaves 37 to go. Yeah, okay. We'll get it done. Any questions or comments so far? Yeah, let's see, get the mic.
When you concentrate on an object, do you just concentrate on one object or can you do two or three at one time?
If you're trying to develop concentration, you would pick one object. You wrote, like I said, you can't have two thoughts in your mind at the same time. According to the Buddhist understanding, you can go back and forth, but that's not really concentration then.
So if I'm concentrating on object, I should stick with just one thought or one object,
yeah.
And not go between two?
Yeah. In general, if you're trying to develop concentration, I would think that would be the
just one object
recommended way. Yeah,
okay.
Stick with one object.
Okay.
Like just the breath. But then when you do these elaborate meditations with images and mantra, you know, that's all considered one object. You know, it has lots of colors and there's sounds, but that's the chosen object. So the object can have various parts or components.
Okay.
But you concentrate on the object as a whole.
Okay, okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Over here?
Are these pretty much unconscious, or can I just been, having knowledge of these, apply these to my perception?
Hold on just a second. My battery pack's winding down. Can you see where that?
Okay.
Got me? Okay, thank you. Go ahead, yeah.
Are these pretty much unconscious, or being aware of them, can I apply them consciously, so to speak, to my perception?
Yeah, right now it's pretty much uncontrolled. You know, it's just chaos if we sit down and look at our mind. That's one of the first things we see as we start to meditate. And various mental factors are coming and going, and it doesn't seem to make any sense. So we have to learn to observe our mind, and then develop some concentration, cultivate the positive mental factors, eliminate the negative factors, you know, accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative. With practice, we can develop some control. But right now, it's just the result of our karma ripening. You know, we don't have any control over it. It's just, like I say, chaotic. Susie.
You mentioned the observer, and that was part of my question. Is our observation of our mind part of the mental factors?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when we get to the beneficial ones, there'll be some characteristics, I think, what you're talking about there. Okay. Over here, Michelle.
So, a quick question. As far as when I've noticed personally that when I meditate, I'm getting to the point now because I've been doing it for a little while, that in some instances I'm able to observe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to react. I don't feel the need to react. I'm just like, oh, well, look at what this person is doing, and that's cool. Or look at what I'm thinking while this person is doing something.
Mm-hmm.
But the days that I either push my meditation back or maybe do a significant amount of less time, it doesn't matter. My mind is just crazy.
Right.
So is that a matter of not remembering to be mindful? Or?
Yeah, it's just you haven't developed the habit of being mindful. And they talk about very much in terms of developing habits. Okay, because this is in the class on karma, it's really not talking. Every time, for example, we're mindful, we're also creating the cause to be mindful again in the future. Okay, every time we are unmindful, we're creating the cause to be unmindful in the future. Okay, so it's like it gets easier with practice.
Every time we do that, we're creating karma?
Any thought creates karma. Any thought, any mental process. Even the most minuscule one is making a karmic imprint. Okay. Any other? Okay. So I'm going to erase these. And now we'll go through the destructive or harmful mental factors. Destructive or harmful because they cause us anxiety. They're not comfortable in our mind. They cause us to be unhappy. So let's see the count. So we're at 14 so far. And then we'll go on to the destructive mental factors. Let's see. Okay, there are three biggies, three big destructive mental factors. Does anybody know what they are? Attachment, or attraction. Okay, attachment. Yeah, no, but attraction. Aversion. And what's the third one? Ignorance, or I'm going to call it confusion here. Okay, these are the three root destructive mental factors. Okay, what's the definition of attachment or attraction? Anybody know? Is it just liking something? You don't want, that's a characteristic, that's good, that's not the core definition. It has that quality to it. Yeah, it means our mind exaggerates the positive qualities of something. Or the good qualities. It's seeing things in this chocolate cake or this beautiful person or this great vacation. Qualities, not just of pleasure, but to make me happy in permanently, forever, if I just have this. So it's being drawn towards something because our mind overestimates its good qualities. Okay? Primarily overestimates its ability to make me happy. Okay? So that's what we mean when we talk about attachment. It's not just liking something, but it's overestimating, which means hallucinating or being delusional about what is actually there. It's a way of not seeing reality, not seeing the way things the way they are. So aversion is the flip side of the coin. It's overestimating the negative qualities, wanting to back away from. Okay, seeing, projecting onto an object, a person, an experience, whatever, qualities, negative qualities that are not really there. So again, it's projecting something out there. Confusion or ignorance, they're both of these are based on ignorance in that we don't see reality as it truly is. Okay, we do not understand the nature of our world and our experience in it. Okay? So attachment, aversion, confusion. Those are the three biggies in terms of the destructive mental factors that can be part, that can accompany one of those primary moments of mind. Again, none of these are always there, okay, but we have certain habits that we develop. So then, after we get through these three, then we have the 20 secondary. Don't you love these lists? Secondary destructive mental factors. Okay. So, and they're all connected to the to one or more of these three. So connected with attachment or attraction, we have avarice, avarice is clinging to one's possessions, self-satisfaction, a sense of superiority because of what one has or has done. And then there's excitement. When we're so attached or attracted to something that our mind can't stay still. Okay, so those come under attachment. Then under aversion, we have wrath, which is the wish to harm. We have vengeance, which is wish to revenge based on past harm that we've had. There's spite, which refers to using harsh speech in this model. There's envy, not being able to tolerate somebody having something we don't have. And then there's cruelty, which is the wish to denigrate. Okay, so these are various secondary forms of aversion. Okay? And then based on confusion, we have concealment, which is hiding our flaws, trying to hide our flaws from others. There's dullness, which is just a very blank, heavy sort of mind. Faithlessness. Faithlessness. Which means not believing in things such, from the Buddhist point of view, are true, like karma. Not believing, not accepting the possibility of becoming enlightened. That would be faithlessness. Laziness. I think we all know what that one is. Forgetfulness. The opposite of mindfulness. When our mind just wanders off and never comes back. And then there's inattention, not being aware of what our actions of body, speech, and mind are. Okay. So let's see. Now we're up to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. We got 14 there. Okay, 3 here. 4 plus 4 is 8. Add 3, put down your 1 and carry 1. We're up to 31, yeah. Okay. Okay, from the combination of attraction and confusion comes pretension. Which is basically making up stories about yourself, and dishonesty. From all three together, we get shamelessness. Which means having no qualms about doing negative actions, lack of consideration, disregard for others. Then we have lack of conscientiousness. Just go put CO in there. Which means not cultivating virtuous practices. And then there's distraction, which means not being able to stay with virtuous actions. Okay, so these five, these 1, 2, 3, 4 come from a combination of all three root destructive mental factors. These two come from a combination of attachment and confusion. Okay, so that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 more. Let's see, shamelessness, lack of consideration, lack of conscientiousness, and distraction. So one? Yeah, those last four. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 more. Okay, so that's 20, 34, 37. Am I right? Am I counting right? Okay. Let's see. What am I leaving out? Let's see. 20. Yeah, let's see. I think I got them all. Let's see. Okay. Let's see. So do I have 20 here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 18, 19, 20 there. Okay, great. 20, so that's 20. Okay, plus we have these three. Okay, plus 14, so that makes 34, 37. I'm not sure if it's going to add up to 51. This may be the 40. There's also a version with 48 in it. So if it doesn't add up, that's okay. Okay, any questions or comments? Okay, these obviously don't accompany every primary moment of mind. They're ones that certain of us seem more familiar with some of them. They seem to come up more for us. But these are ones that disturb the mind, lead to unhappiness, lead to us hurting others, okay, lead to us creating negative karma. When these factors are added on to primary moments of mind. So these are the ones we want to start to recognize, start to look at their negative effects on our mind, and develop the wish and the aspiration to discard them. Okay? Yeah, you got the mic. Okay, good.
As far as laziness,
mm-hmm.
Would sitting down for like an hour or 2 hours a day, would that be, should we be doing something all the time throughout the day, or?
Well, I think, you know, that would be the ideal, but I think you have to be realistic also, okay? And you don't want to push yourself harder than you can. That's not beneficial, yeah. But, you know, you have to start where you are, so to speak. Yeah. Uh-huh. Don't expect to be a great yogi after, you know, after a year or two. Yeah. Were you going to say something?
Number four of the 20, attention and dishonesty. What is that a combination of?
Attraction and confusion. Okay, or attachment and confusion.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so we've talked about all the bad stuff. Now let's go through the good stuff, okay? Yeah, I think this is... Oh, I know what it is. Sometimes the root destructive mental factors, sometimes there's six of them. Sometimes there are three of them. If you're using the six version, you get 51. If you're using the three version, like I did here, you only get 48. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I like having those three by themselves because they're so important. But if if you want to go the six version, the other three are, I can't remember. I remember reading it. Yeah. But yeah, just stick with those three. That's a clearer way of doing it. Okay. So there are 11 beneficial mental factors. Okay. Okay. Or constructive. And let's see. There's faith, self-respect, consideration, detachment, non-hatred, non-confusion, enthusiasm, suppleness, referring to mental suppleness, conscientiousness, equanimity, and nonviolence. So you can see a lot of these just the opposite of a lot of the negative mental factors. Faith, self-respect, consideration. This consideration means in particularly not doing negative actions out of respect for others. Non-hatred, non-confusion, enthusiasm, the opposite of laziness, conscientiousness, suppleness is, allows the mind to engage in virtuous activities. Conscientiousness stays with virtuous activities. Equanimity is getting away from attachment and aversion, and then nonviolence is the freedom from the wish to harm others. So these are the 11 beneficial or virtuous mental factors. And we're familiar with all of these. And again, any possible combination of these mental factors can go with one primary moment of mind. You know, our thoughts are very complicated and they're often mixed. And you know, one moment of mind will have both positive and negative mental factors that are accompanying it. But according to the Buddha, by practice, by watching our mind, we can completely eliminate all the negative mental factors from our mind so that they never even arise. That not, you know, it's not that we get rid of them once they're there, but they're completely gone and our mind is filled with nothing but primary mental moments that are accompanied by beneficial mental factors. And that's the difference between our mind and a Buddha's mind. Okay, we've got a lot of these negative mental factors. The Buddha's cleaned them out, gotten rid of all the karma that accompanies them, and does not have those harmful mental factors accompanying any thoughts. So you have a question, Joanna?
Can you explain how you're using the word detachment?
Detachment, yes, okay. It's the antidote to attachment. It's the ability to draw back from an object of attachment. You know, we're attached to something, we go to it. Detachment is the ability to pull yourself back. So it's a direct antidote to attachment. Okay, any other questions or comments? Okay, equanimity is allowing the mind to stay in a calm, not up and down based on attachment and aversion, okay? But it's just a calming of the mind, okay? Any other questions? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How do there get to be so many more destructive factors?
That's a good question. I don't know. That's a cosmology question. Why are there so more? It doesn't seem fair, does it? Yeah. I think that's a great question, and I cannot answer it. That's a good question for a geshe. That's what you always say when you can't answer a question up here. But it seems it's striking that there are more negative mental factors than beneficial ones. Okay. I don't expect anybody to memorize those. Obviously, I don't have them memorized, and I've taught this class several times. But it's very useful to watch your mind and start to get a sense of which mental factors are coming up over and over again and which ones seem to be absent that you would like to be there, and that's something that we actually have some control over. It will seem very slow and very painful, but we can eliminate the negative mental factors from our mind. Well, that's what the Buddha said, at least. Okay, let's do another meditation. We're not going to meditate on the mental factors. I think that'd be a little dry right now. We're going to do a clarity of consciousness meditation. It was written by a Tibetan nun. It's a little bit different from the way I usually lead it, but I thought it'd be worth trying. Okay. So begin by checking your posture. Identify any sources of tension right now and kind of address them so they won't be distracting you. Three deep breaths from the abdomen. And now allow your breath to return to its normal pattern and take a moment to set your motivation for the practice that follows. Thank you. And having set your motivation, now begin with just a couple minutes of placing the concentration on the breath. So our mind becomes a little bit more focused, a little bit less distracted. We can let all the talk just set all that aside and just watch the breath. And now we're going to begin the meditation on the clarity of the mind. And this will be a guided meditation. I'll be talking. We're going to use the mind's ability to visualize or imagine or see things. And we'll use a couple images to see if we can get a sense of the clarity of the mind, the clarity of consciousness. So generate an image of spacious clarity. For example, imagine you are lying on the top of a hill with an unobstructed view. No trees, no buildings, just gazing up into the perfectly clear blue sky without clouds or pollution of any kind. So establish that image first. Imagine that. Focus your awareness on this luminous spaciousness. And allow yourself to merge with it. You and the luminous spaciousness, your mind and the luminous spaciousness are one. Mind and spaciousness. No distinction, no duality. They are the same. Your mind is empty, clear, and luminous. No sense of separation, no sense of duality. Hold your awareness in this experience of empty luminosity. Just that. No thinking of this or that. No judgment. No emotion. Direct perception of empty space. This is the clear, pure nature of the mind. Just stay there, aware, relaxed, but focused. When thoughts or emotions arise in this space, don't engage with them, don't react to them, don't go towards them, don't push them away. Just watch them arise, exist, and subside. Just let them go and stay with the clear space. Just observe the thoughts arise in the clear space with neutrality, no charge. And as the thought goes away, come back to the clear space. Totally relaxed with the experience of clear space. Thoughts arise and subside, but the clear space remains. And you can relax your concentration and do a brief dedication. Okay, so this coming week I'd like you to meditate on the clear space of the mind 6 days out of the week. You can use that image that I described in that meditation of looking up into the sky. Or if you have another image that works better for you, that's perfectly okay. So do that 6 days out of this week. Next week we're going to do a lot more meditation. I'm not going to bring up any new material, and we'll have time for discussion of any questions you have about anything we've covered in the class so far. And there will be a discussion group starting out in the lobby in a couple minutes. Yes, Susie.
Can you tell us where that meditation is from? Is it from the meditation book?
That is in the online. It's in Discovering Buddhism at Home online. It's in, let's see, session three. At the end of session three. Yes.
When we pick an object, how long should we look at it throughout the day? I mean, stare at it for like an hour, or how long should you look at the object so you can picture it in your mind?
Whatever you need to become familiar with it. Yeah, it's going to be different for different objects. You know, if you're meditating on one of these tankas or something, you're going to want to study it quite intently because there's a lot of detail. But if you're just meditating on your breath, that's always there, so you don't need to really study it that much.
Okay.
It's going to, yeah, but start with something simple, yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
For the meditation you wanted us to do 6 days, is there an amount of time that we should aim for?
I'd say about 10 minutes, yeah, no more. Yeah, it doesn't have to be any longer than that, okay? If you want to go longer, that's great, but I'd kind of keep 10 minutes as the minimal, okay? And do the dedication, the motivation, the dedication. I think that helps, even if it seems a little foreign at first. Okay, see y'all next week. What's the next Discovering Buddhism module? Okay, so the next module, which starts December...
The first Monday of December.
First Monday of December is going to be all meditation, yeah. Thank you.